So I'm Ian Painter. I'm at the University of Washington. I'm a clinical assistant professor there, and clinical is another word for kind of assistant professor. I don't do anything clinical. So I'm going to talk about a very quantitative talk after the last two about work we've been doing to try and improve the data quality of the data within the distributed system. So this is work done jointly with by a team at the University of Washington and also Don Olson and Ann Gifford at the ISDS. So a little bit of background on the distributed system will be important. So this system was set up more or less as an experiment by several jurisdictions to be able to share aggregate data on a flexible, easy to set up system that they controlled. But basically from the purposes of this talk, probably the most, there's two important aspects about distribute. One is that distribute uses aggregate data. So we get data from participating jurisdictions on its syndromic surveillance data specifically for influenza-like illness. And the data we get is aggregated up to the level of a jurisdiction. So basically we get counts of ILI-like illness and total number of visits. And we also have some experimental pilots going on with GI. And so the sites aggregate the data, so we only ever see the data in aggregate, and we don't have any way of directly going back to look at individual encounters which make up that aggregate. The other aspect is that because we, when the system was set up, we were trying to create a very low barrier to entry. We had no standard definition of what constituted ILI like illness. It was basically whatever the jurisdiction feels is ILI to them was what we took. And we took data in a number of different formats and weren't too fussy if the data only came irregularly or if there were problems with the upload. So we were trying to make it, generally speaking, that was me yesterday. Generally speaking, we're trying to make it as easy as possible to share the data. And as a result of that, especially initially, the quality of that data was often not particularly good. Now, just this illustrates three of the kind of issues we see in the data. And there's three time series graphs here. The first shows for a particular jurisdiction the total number of ED visits per day over a period of time. The second one shows for a different jurisdiction the ILI ratio over time. And the bottom one, again, shows the total counts over time. And so the first major issue we face is that there tended to be a lot of instability in the total number of ED visits that we would observe from a jurisdiction. And this is almost always the case because we're looking at aggregate data. We don't get to see the individual facilities reporting to a jurisdiction. If a facility drops out or another facility is added in, or if accidentally a facility is double counted, then we see these sudden jumps in the total number of ED visits. The second kind of problem we see are these spurious jumps in the ILI ratio, very typically at the most recent data point. So here you can clearly see the seasonality in the ILI ratio, except for the most recent day, there's this very uncharacteristic in terms of a time series jump in the ILI ratio. And this is almost certainly due to a drop in data, the amount of data we received for that day. So for some reason we've only received a very little bit of the data for that day. The denominator has dropped right off, and that really inflates whatever, that creates a lot of instability in the ratio for that day. The third problem we see, or issue we dealt with, was whether something was a data quality problem or whether it was an actual event. So here on the left, we have something that looks like a data quality problem. And again, does this thing have a mouse? In January, And actually, the year before, we see a similar kind of pattern, which looked like data quality problems. Well, these actually, for this jurisdiction, corresponded to snowstorms. And there was simply a big drop in the number of people who could get to the to various facilities. So sometimes we have a hard time, we would have a hard time figuring out, was something a data quality issue, in which case we'd want to correct it or flag it, or was it a true anomaly, in which case we'd want to know that too. So we only have access to aggregate data, and another important thing is that the data accrues over time. When we get data today, when the data file is loaded for a particular jurisdiction, it typically contains some counts for the day before, some counts for the day before that, and we typically go back to a 21-day rolling count. And this is a result of, and since different facilities at a jurisdiction may report at different frequencies to the jurisdiction, when it gets aggregated, we see that, you know, for jurisdiction, we might typically get 10% of the data for yesterday, today, and then 20% for 2 days ago, and so on. So we have this data accrual over time. So this just shows kind of a time series plot over time of the data, and you can see that it's always rising from below, indicating that, you know, for the generally speaking, we have some data for the most recent 2 days, but it's not really much, and it really takes about 4 days before we get up to a point here where we have, for this jurisdiction, most of the data. And the stuttering you see is weekends when they're not reporting any data. So for the weekends, we get 2 days with no data. So we were particularly interested in two aspects of the data quality. One was on developing a monitoring process to improve the data quality, and the other was doing an analysis of the data quality to try and understand the issues and potential solutions. And we started with the analysis of the data quality. There's really three aspects we looked at in particular. One was timeliness, one was completeness, and one was accuracy. And they're all intimately related, so it's very hard to pull out one without thinking about the others. We did a number of different, our analysis was almost entirely visual, because there was not much need to do particular formal analyses to get information, to understand the data quality, with one exception. So one of the things we found very useful was to look at the pattern of uploads we got from jurisdictions. This is fairly hard to read, so I'll enlarge it. The x-axis is basically particular days on which this jurisdiction uploaded a file to us. And the y-axis shows the dates contained in that file. So you can see for this jurisdiction, there's a lot of gaps, days which they didn't upload a file. Typically, when they did upload a file, there's a set number of days included in that data. So it will go back from, and the black line is today, so it'll go back from 1 day ago to about 10 days ago. And then you see things like this line here, indicate a batch upload of a long string of dates, typically to correct for a data quality problem or because they've added another facility and they want to allow us to catch up with that data. And we played around with a number of ways to try and simplify that, and we saw that different jurisdictions had very different patterns in terms of the uploads, in terms of how many times they had to do long catch-ups and things. We also looked at trying to understand the timeliness of the sites, and we basically created these histograms where each line represents a particular lag day, and the x-axis represents how complete the data was, and the histogram represents what proportion of time was in each place. So on day zero, we had 100% of the time no data for this site. By 1 day after the date, we had 65% of the time we had all of the data, and 22% of the time we had no data, and then the rest was spread out, and so on. And we tended to see these two or three different patterns in this. We had patterns where it's very bimodal, where most of the time there's either no data or we have all the data. We have patterns where it's a bit more spread out, and then we have patterns where there's this real long accrual over time until it takes to get all of the data. And so that graph, timeliness and completion, closely tied together. And to come up with kind of an overall summary of timeliness and completion for each jurisdiction, we created what we call timeliness completion summaries. And basically, the x-axis shows how long ago the data was for, the lag, and the y-axis shows the proportion of time, the mean proportion complete for each site. So you can see there's a lot of variability here, there, just zooming in. You know, there's some sites which straight away after one day we have the data is always complete, and so on. So this is just another way for us to get a handle on it. And this is how I'll come back to this later in comparing how well data monitoring process worked. I'm just going to skip through this just to say that we found it very, because data accrues over time, we found it very useful to look at, rather than just a historical time series of the data, we needed to look at what the data looked like one day after we received it as a time series, what the data looked like 2 days after we received it as a time series. And it was only by looking at it, a series of time series like that, that we could gain a handle on what was happening. And the last part of the analysis was measuring accuracy. So if we suppose we had for example, if you calculate the ILI ratio for yesterday as, say, 0.13, what we want to know is for this particular site, it takes 10 days to get all the data. How accurate is the value we calculated today for yesterday going to be compared to what the final value will be when we get all of the data? And so we created some horn plots to show us the, basically it's on a log scale, but it shows the relative error as a function of lag. So this is for one particular site where after one day it has plus or minus roughly 10% error. So that's actually pretty good. And then it tapers down over time. We got different sites had very different patterns. Some sites were essentially biased, so most of the time for this site, the ILI ratio you calculate for yesterday will be too low compared to the final ILI ratio. And then we're able to reverse that process, those horn plots, to create prediction intervals to put on time series graphs. Well, that's the kind of the next step in this process, to give an idea of what the ILI ratio will be once you have all the complete data, given what you see at the moment. So here, this is one day behind, so this is showing that, you know, we calculated a ratio of 0.02 yesterday, but really we don't have a good idea if it's between 0.01 and 0.07. So for this particular site, the one day old ratio has a huge amount of error in it. And then for other sites we get the data accruing much quicker, or at least not necessarily occurring quicker, but the accuracy occurring much quicker. I'm going to skip over that. So once we had an idea about what the different data quality problems we were seeing were, we started a data monitoring process. Part of it is automated monitoring, and part of it is manual monitoring. The automated monitoring process is mainly focused on data uploads, making sure that sites send their data to us. So we send out email notifications if there's problems. And we have an automatically generated summary table showing different sites and when they last uploaded. And we can link to we actually use the Google Calendar widget, link to that to look at what data was uploaded for a particular site on a particular day. But we found that was not nearly enough just to look at when they uploaded. We actually had to look at the content, and for that we started a manual monitoring process. We basically created a summary table. We did this on a weekly basis. We created a summary table and a time series, and we looked through those to try and look for any obvious anomalies, and a lot of it initially was just looking through them to try and understand the kinds of patterns we saw. I'm going to skip through actual examples. So we basically started a process to document whatever data anomalies we saw kind of classify them and to resolve discrepancies. And to facilitate this, because this was done jointly at University of Washington and ISDS, based in Boston, and Don in New York helping, we created a Google site to document all the anomalies that we found, and we created a list of the common anomalies that we found. So we basically have a Google site where you can go to do the data quality monitoring. It has a log entry form that you can use to enter the data directly rather than putting it directly into the spreadsheet. And then the data goes into a spreadsheet, and so for example you can see we have a timestamp, the date essentially that we looked at the data, whether the problem, we consider it to be high, medium, or low, a brief summary of what the problem was, some additional descriptions, which site, date observed, who observed it, how they observed it, and the date it was resolved, or if it's been resolved, and who resolved it. And so this allowed us to keep track of what anomalies were occurring, and also keep track of the patterns of the type of anomalies that we saw. So we created a library of common errors so that we could at least refer to them with the same name. Probably the most common was, one of the most common was an untimely upload pattern. And this was really something that refers to the site. So some sites were very regular in having uploads, and if we saw a missed upload with that site, we would conclude that there was some kind of problem with that site. It wasn't normal. Other sites, would typically be 3 or 4 days late in their upload, or it may take up to 3 or 4 days to get an upload for a certain date, and so we wouldn't worry about contacting a site until it had gone well past, until it had gone past what we expected to see for that site. Basically, the anomaly types we could categorize into four major categories. One was fluctuating total counts. Another was like a step-like increase or decrease in the counts or ratio. Another was a spike-like increase or decrease in the counts. And the last one was the missing data. There's simply no data there. We looked at this basically over a 6-month period starting in 2010, and we observed a total of 131 discrepancies, and of those, 39 of them appeared to be real anomalies. That's when we contacted the site. They said, this is not a data quality problem, this is really what it is, what the data is. 6 of them we couldn't figure out what was going on, and the remaining of them we said these are data quality issues. We were able to resolve about 71 of these issues, and at the end of that 6-month period there were 15 issues that we still hadn't resolved. And some of those issues are things like, the IT person at a site leaves, the system goes down that they use to send their data, and there's no one there who can set it back up. So some problems are essentially unresolvable. This just shows the kind of variation we see in the number of discrepancies by site. It's not everything's roughly in the same order of magnitude, I guess. Nothing's really vastly higher than the other than others. This shows the discrepancy by the type of discrepancy, and so you can see decreased counts was the most common, followed by missing data, and then unexpected increase in counts. And then after the data quality process had been run in 2010, we compared the first 3 months in 2010, which was before we ran the data quality process, with the first 3 months of 2011 after we'd run this process. And we basically looked at, this is the timeliness completion summary curve. So you can see that prior to doing this monitoring process, we have, even after 20 days over all of the sites taken together, we still, on average, only had about 60% of the data. And then after we'd done the monitoring process, after about 3 or 4 days, we had 80% of the data. So there was a big improvement in the timeliness completion of the data that we got. A lot of that has to do with experience we got in having sites join. So there were many sites joining in that intermediate period, and we were more strict about how we accepted the data from them. So some of this is not just, well, a lot of the improvement is not just from a data monitoring process, but we believe at least a substantial part of it is. We started to look at automating the manual monitoring process, but we found that's quite difficult, in part due to the high site-to-site variability we see between the sites. And so whatever methods we would use would have to adapt to the individual site patterns, and some of those patterns are really, the differences are qualitative rather than quantitative in nature. We found that when we use data streams collected at a fixed lag, so the idea of looking at what the data looked like as a time series 1 day after we received it, or what it looked like, 1 day after it occurred, or what it looked like as a time series 2 days after it occurred, really helped. And the biggest kind of target that we think for automated monitoring is the step-like changes in total counts that we see. And so we're investigating using change point methods. We're building on some work of Taha and Roy at Biosense that they've done using change point methods. So we're investigating use of change point methods to try and find these step-like changes. So just in conclusion, we found a great deal of heterogeneity in sites. There's a great deal of, even within a site, there was a great deal of noise. We found for automated detection, the kind of classical statistical process control methods that we tried didn't work very well. We think there's better ways that we can do the automated method, automated monitoring, but we haven't implemented those yet. I'm just going to skip over this. Time's up. And this work was funded by the CDC Biosense project through a subcontract with ISDS. And the funding for Distribute comes from CDC Biosense, and also it came from Markle Foundation. And I say one other thing we've done for the monitoring process is that we have a weekly data monitoring quality call between the team. And we've been fortunate that folks from the CDC Biosense and Influenza Division have been able to join us on those calls from time to time, and that's been really helpful to get suggestions on what aspects of data quality should we be focusing on and aspects like that. Anyway, thank you.
Okay. Are there any questions?
This was an excellent presentation. I still remember back in biostats class in grad school, one of the things that we talked about was clinical significance versus statistical significance. So one of my questions to you on this is that you've gone to a great deal of trouble to look at the details, quantitative details. And now my question to you is backing up in the bigger picture, the public health significance. So when you look at these potential errors and margins and or uncertainty, I guess, until you get the final data, how would that impact any decisions? I mean, do you think that the spread is large enough that you would have made a different decision public health-wise versus not, like, for example, with influenza, closing schools versus not closing schools, things like that?
Yes, but it varied from site to site, but there were definitely a large number of sites where you would not want to make a decision based on the most recent data point. And that's the other way where we would like, let's go back to this really quick, quickly. If we're in a site like this, then if you look, the kind of error after 1 day is smaller than the typical day-to-day magnitude of the ratio. And so in this case, you feel reasonably confident, especially about making a decision that nothing was happening. This is an example of where there's a a spike in the count. This is at a constant lag. So this is looking at what the data looked like for 3 days ago. And we put in place a process to try and detect when that would occur to create these intervals. And you can see that it detected that it was a sudden spike. And when there's a sudden spike, the most likely source of that spike is a data quality problem. So we have a system where it puts wider confidence intervals on that spike. So it's for knowing that nothing's going on, for reassurance, it can work pretty well. Less certain about, you know, when there's a sudden spike, it's hard to tell, is it a data quality problem or is it something real? And obviously when you get a site like this, you would not want to make any decision on maybe, you know, until you had 6 or 7 days after the date. And perhaps the most sensible way to implement this, to use this, would be to have a flag which basically says, you know, the data is not reliable at this stage.
Okay, any more questions?
I'd like to suggest a hypothesis that when something is going on as far as disease activity, that the reporting sites, their reporting behavior might be different from when nothing is going on. So with that in mind, that very wide confidence limit you showed, especially the upper limit, might that be too conservative? For example, if you went back and looked at your confirmed anomalies and to find out that those were all reported promptly, that would suggest that that upper confidence limit might be too conservative.
Yes, and in effect, the width of this confidence interval here is based on just that. So the flag to see if there's a sudden change, but then the width of that interval with that flag would depend on the historic behavior when there's a sudden change. So if when there's a sudden change, it's always real, then it wouldn't have a wide confidence interval.
I was thinking of the other one where you showed it really wide for 1 day, and that's what I thought might be conservative, at least at the upper end.
Yes, and I think one aspect with this is not taking into account the kind of using a previous day to predict today's ILI. So clearly, you know, looking at this data in terms of, there's nothing unreasonable looking about that time series. But that's because we're comparing it for, you know, what it typically does in terms of the actual ILI ratio. And we've been focusing on just trying to predict how good the calculated ILI ratio is compared to the real one. So rather than trying, we're not using any kind of trend analysis of what's happening with ILI. We're simply trying to take into account the effect of timeliness completion issues.
Do we have any questions for any of the presenters? We have three.
Hi, I've got two questions, one for each of the first two presenters. So the first question from the gentleman from Northrop Grumman is, you mentioned that the development of the software was open source, so where can we get access to the source or download the demo of what you developed? And then, well, we'll start there, and then I've got a second question for the other one.
Yeah, thank you very much. Actually, if you contact me, I will put you in touch with Dr. Paul Picciano and Aptima Inc., and you know, and you can proceed from there. They are the ones that actually had the contract with, you know, Tatrick, and we supported them during the conduct of this research. So, if my card's available, just see me afterwards, and I'll be happy to set that up.
Great. And then the second question actually is, could go out to the entire group, and that is that I'm wondering what kind of impact the revised guidelines for syndromic surveillance reporting will have on meaningful use. And that is, if you look at what's on the NIST website in terms of the criteria for certification for the meaningful use criteria for syndromic surveillance, it specifically mentions ORU messages and not ADTs. And so I'm wondering if the revised guidelines now focus on, in my opinion, rightly so, on ADT instead of ORU. What kind of implication does this have for folks who have attested to meaningful use to date and plan to attest for meaningful use later this year and have been developing towards ORU. We've had several hospitals contact us and say, I'm sending you ADTs today, but these criteria say I have to use ORU. So I'm just wondering if anyone in the room has given that some thought or has some insight. Oh, this is Brian Dixon from the Regan Streep Institute.
Well, first of all, let me just say, with regard to the recommendation, I think it's very exciting, but I also think it's very embryonic. There's three areas that I follow very closely, immunization registries and the exchange and harmonization of standards around immunizations. The second is surveillance, you know, just in general, the ability to do surveillance from electronic health records. And even CMS types, you know, lesser forms of health data, including, you know, benefits, claims data, things of that nature. And then in the third area, electronic laboratory reporting, you know, as a source of surveillance as well as a source of activity, you know, gauging what's going on in the public health community and the depth and vibrancy of the data that's available to public health that is quantifiable. And so, to me, it's a very exciting time. We're studying that. I support ISDS and all of the various programs, and, you know, I think it's a little bit premature to get out the tea leaves or the crystal ball and read what will happen. But I do believe that it's a very positive step forward, and I think it does give us another brick in the foundation of things that will enable public health, you know, over the next 10 years or so as we go forward. So I'll defer to Ian and Dave and Dan.
I'm not familiar. I thought I looked at the... You know, the approved test procedure that they're using for certification criteria now, doesn't it just say to use the 251 message? I don't think it specifies whether it's an ORU, ADT, I think at this point. Is that, am I correct on that? Yeah, that was the unfortunate part. That initial standard went out there by mistake, and I don't know how that happened, but it did. So, last night, because I work on FIN certification, so I took a look at some of the NIST test procedures that they're doing, and I thought the latest one I looked at, they didn't specify a standard message type. They just specified HL7251, which is pretty generic. Can they do that? So I think that's probably what they're evaluating them against. And I think they, on their HL7 validator tool, I don't think they have the syndromic surveillance, any of the testing there. Last time I looked anyway.
Any more questions?
I'm not sure who this goes to. I'm Mark Swanson here at the CDC, and it has to do with the Affordable Care Act passed, included in that a provision that disability status was to be one of the new demographic variables that was collected. And look at these systems here. I know there's some, I guess in the second presentation, the required and the optional variables. And what is the process, or how would that happen where that would be added in if it was observed as the law to add another required field on that? Is that just, they just added in, or I don't know who approves that or how that process works. I just was curious.
Are there some ISDS representatives here that would like to? I know the data elements came from them.
I've got a little bit of insight there. We support the Social Security Administration. And basically right now, with regard to processing disabilities, what they're doing is it's all imaged information. Everything that comes in, it's not really in a structured data source that you can analyze, and they're looking to rapidly move to that. Their current situation is that they've had a system now, it's quite good, but it's all based upon imaging the data that comes in and establishing the disability case. And what they're looking for in
what we believe will be their next series of procurements will be to move in a different direction, that it will actually go in the area that I think you're suggesting. Second thing is, though, that with regard to military health, we can actually learn a lot from the Veterans Administration and what they're doing with their data. There is much to be leveraged from how the VA and electronic health records are being done and used there, and things like Blue Button, which was mentioned in the planetary session, which incidentally Northrop Grumman supported the Blue Button, but I've got to get one advertisement in here. We supported that. We actually have an iPhone app and an Android app, which is Blue Button enabled, and so you can give someone permission to get to all your health records in an electronic way just by literally pushing a button and using that as your electronic signature. So I'm happy to talk further if someone has a more specific question.
My name is Julia Gunn, and I'm on the board of directors of ISDS and was part of the group that worked on the documents for ISDS. And in the audience, we have Aaron Kite-Powell from Florida, who is also part of that group. And if he's, yes, he's hiding behind that pole, and that's Aaron. Aaron, raise your hand. And there's Brian Karras. You can always find him with the hat. He's very tall in any group, and just look for that hat. Very telling. And so a little bit about like how the data elements were chosen. This was a group of practitioners from state, local health departments, some from an informatics framework, some from a practice framework. And basically we were looking at sort of the common ground of what was the state of syndromic surveillance, where we are today. And then after much discussion and deliberation, understanding that we had a very short period of time. And for a lot of the data elements in hospital systems, it's not well understood what's going to be their utility. And then in addition to that, what are the resources that are going to be needed to process them? So if you were to look at, say, radiology reports, you need some sort of language programming to look for free text, to categorize that. So there are different complexities. And also about the state of public health surveillance systems and what modifications we would all have to be making on our end to support that. And then we came up with this use case based on what is current practice, what have people found to be of value, and then added a few that we think for future work may have some potential for moving the field forward. We kept this focused on urgent care and emergency room department settings because that is where the most experience is. The workflows and the patterns in ambulatory care, we have limited experience with. That is an area we'll be struggling with and debating and talking about in our communities as we move forward to advance the field of syndromic surveillance. However, people have other ideas and suggestions about data elements that they've had experience with and want to put forward for consideration as we move forward. That should be that can be communicated to folks at ISDS and go to the website, and we can start to collect that information, and that may help us guide us for future developments. The reason some went required but empty, you also have to think about what happens in an emergency. And in an emergency, data is not entered. People aren't, registration is unknown person one with a default date of birth of 1/1/1900 and a medical record to get things going. So a lot of the data elements may not be there, but in these kind of events, it's very important for public health to at least have a sense of what's the velocity of care-seeking behaviors at our hospitals, because not all people will be coming from emergency management services. When you look at large-scale events, a lot of people are the walk-ins and things like that, and that all impacts on what we may be seeing during events. And so we didn't want to limit ourselves to say it's got to be required and filled out. And as we struggled to go through some of this, those were the real-world considerations in the development of some of these recommendations. So people have ideas. We would really love to hear about that at ISDS, and also my other partners in local and state public health, and Aaron and Brian, if you have any other ideas or suggestions, please chime in.
Any other questions?
You might want to announce that there was an earthquake in
5.8.
Okay, we'll let
you know. Oh, that was it. Okay, I have a question for the three presenters. Do we have any, lessons learned or any gotchas or any key takeaway points for the audience? You can be brief. Anything?
Well, I'm never brief. But one thing I can say is that this is very exciting, and the reason why it's exciting is because I liken this in public health to where we were, let's say you go back to the late 1800s, early 1900s, where you had electricity being developed and deployed on a citywide scale. You had the first sanitation systems being developed and deployed, first water systems. And if you kind of, and the first, you go on from the horse and carriage to Henry Ford's horseless carriage, in many ways, I see us in that embryonic, exciting mixture of where innovation, entrepreneurism, transition from where we are to where we want to be is occurring right now. And so, to me, there's no more exciting time to be alive because most of us have seen doing things as epidemiologists by hand in our green books and then having the tools incrementally present themselves that have advanced public health practice. And so, for me, this is an exciting time to be in surveillance and in public health, and never has it been needed more.
Thank you.
Okay, I think I just wanted to say that, it's very exciting and we're going to get lots of data and data we haven't seen before. But I think the experience has been with most sources of surveillance data is that you need to spend some time to understand the data in order to understand the data, if that makes sense. You can't just expect this data will come along and it will tell us lots of stuff. It's probably not going to happen. You're going to have to spend a lot of time understanding the patterns in the data, what the data means, going back to the source, things like that.
Thank you. Mark?
These are my opinions and not necessarily that of the CDC. But one of the things that we went through with the syndromic surveillance, the wrong standard got out there and it didn't have enough vetting initially, so my advice is to take a look at this work that's going on at the future stage one, stage two, stage three, to make sure the right standards are getting in there and provide your feedback in it so we don't have to scramble at the last minute to try and get the right guide out there, the right specification out there, and use the right standard. So take a look at the work while the money's out there flowing into the EHR systems. Right. Look to take advantage of that.
Okay, wonderful. Do we have any more questions before we close? Okay, great. Well, I'd just like to remind everyone before we thank our three presenters, take time to go to the website and do the survey for the conference. It's really going to help plan the conferences in the future. So let's thank our three presenters. We have Mark Jensen, Ian Painter, and Dr. Fred Grant. Thank you.